Good morning.
Good morning.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Good. It's good to be back here and have this opportunity to share these reflections with each other. Christ would help us. I'd like to begin by taking a few minutes to share some of my personal impressions of the book, Philip Knoll's book, and what I liked about it, some positive criticism and just impressions of it, personal impressions. And then I'd like to turn to the subject matter of the book, which I guess is its significance, really, is its subject matter. And turning to the subject matter as Lectio Divina, that is, turning to the book as a prayer. And so that the core themes of the book are invitations for us to explore our experience of and fidelity to those aspects of our life, which makes it Lectio Divina. And I guess we're going to go here until 11, then we're going to take a little break, come back, I'll finish up for maybe another 20 minutes, and then we'll open up for maybe 20 minutes of dialogue in the noon. So first impressions of the book. I guess basically I liked the book. It'd be awkward if I didn't. But I did like the book. I liked it first because of its subject matter. I think it's a book that, as Tillich phrases it, invites us to turn towards matters of ultimate concern. That it reminds us that one aspect of our faith is that it invites us to reflect on what matters most. That is, what does it mean to be a human being? That is, what is the nature of my situation? What is the nature of our situation with each other? And what is my response to that? And how do I bear witness to that? These are fundamental questions. So the book is good in the sense that it does this. I think the book is also good in that it does this specifically in the language of our Christian tradition. That is, how does our faith in Christ shed light on our understanding of the meaning of our life and give us strength and courage and so on to bear witness to that. I also like the book in that it's very accessible. You know, some books are they kind of expect a certain background in order to understand them. And just the words that they use, and if every third sentence is a word you don't know, there's no footnotes, you kind of just tell the writers writing for people who have background in a certain area. They know the in talk. And also some writers will have their own private little view of things. So they require you to come to them to understand it. Now, if it's really worthwhile, it's worth coming to them. But you got to be willing to do your homework and write it out, what this person's saying. But this book is very accessible. It's the kind of book that goes to the reader and doesn't ask the reader to come to the writer. And it speaks in very accessible language about things that matter most in the Christian tradition. It casts a very wide net with lots of examples and so on. So it's a very inviting book. Kind of eases us into these reflections. I think the book is also good in that it points out something that many people identify with as problematic. Namely, certain attitudes in our own Christian tradition that we get the sense are not helpful, are discouraging or negative, kind of hard to buy into. And things we hear from the pulpit, where we, Catholic education, we learned in the classroom, and I remember I went through a phase of my own spiritual journey where for a while I dropped out of the church, and I couldn't see how God could buy into an outfit like this. Give me a break.
Seriously? Really?
Honest to God, really. And he's honest about that. He invites us to be honest about it. But like, not the emperor with no clothes on. We can kind of see this isn't looking good. And lastly, I like the book because then he gives us an antidote for our discouragement and invites us to see in Celtic Christianity kind of an optimistic, life-giving, vibrant, down-to-earth sense of Christ in our life and so on. And he introduces us to this Celtic spirituality. That's my sense of the book. Does that make sense in a way? And what I would hold as constructive criticism to this fine book is that I would say that I think he could have done, I think he wasn't careful as he could have been not to be simplistic. And here's the sense I have of him. He takes these core themes, I think there's eight of them, eight chapters, eight core themes of life. And he says that when Rome became the official, like the power of the state became the power of the religion, you get in this kind of official, hierarchical, patriarchal structure of Rome, these negative attitudes. Over here, you get in the early church, the Gnostic church and the Celtic church. So his book goes like this. Let's take the first theme. We look at the first theme. How does Rome look at it? Boo, Rome. How do the Celts look at it? Yay, Celts. Over here, Rome. Boo, Rome. Over here, Celts. Yay, Celts. You know, and when you're done, you walk up carrying your Celtic flag and have a glass of green beer and be happy. And by the way, I think there's some truth to that. That's the power of the book. It's not, that's the thing. It would be easier if you were making it up. But it's true. It's really true. I heard there's a show I listened to on public radio, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Very clever show. And they said that now that Annie Rooney's passed away, rumors on who's going to take his place. And one person heard that the Pope, the church, is thinking that the Pope can retire, and the present Pope has been approached to have the Andy Rooney spot. And he'll come on and say, "Do you ever wonder why those wafers are so dry?" So it's true, but I would put it this way. Now I want to switch to the subject matter of the book. And by the way, I want to say, kind of having empathy with Philip here on this, there's a creative tension on how wide you can cast the net without compromising your subject matter. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's really a creative tension there. You can only make it so accessible without in some way not being true to the depth of what you're talking about. And that's a tough call. And I think he leans towards pastoral question of how to make it accessible to give people a taste, to invite them in. And I think that's his strategy, and it's a good one. But I would set the book up differently. Instead of making it Rome Celtic, I would put it more this way. Let's say up here are certain attitudes that have come into the church for different reasons. You can trace it culturally what those are. Is kind of negative or not life-giving or against the body, against sexuality, then not acknowledging the earth and so on. And underneath, instead of Celtic Christianity, I would like to speak instead about contemplative Christianity or mystical Christianity. So if we look at it, contemplative Christianity historically, you can say here's Celtic Christianity. Over here is Celtic Christianity. But over here in Italy, it's St. Francis and St. Clair and Bonaventure and the rule of St. Benedict. In Germany, you have Meister Eckhart, Henry Suso, Johannes Tauler, the Flemish mystic Ruysbroeck. In England, you have the Cloud of Unknowing, Julianne of Norwich, and so on. In America, you say you have Thomas Merton. So you see a cross in the Eastern Church, St. Basil, the Philokalia, Mount Athos. So what you find is this polyphony of contemplative voices, of contemplative Christianity. And many of these mystics within the Roman tradition found no trouble at all expressing these same radical things within the Roman tradition. John of the Cross was an ordained priest. Meister Eckhart was a priest. Eckhart taught theology at the University of Paris. And so I would think it's more fruitful that way, to look at it that way, rather than Rome, boo, Celtic, yay. Look at it more like, how do we, in a process of perpetual conversion, come to a truer, more kind of life-sustaining death dimension of our own Christian tradition? Does that make sense in a way? And I'd like to walk through these themes then. And it isn't as if we have time to finish all eight. But I think if we get enough to pick up the tone of it, kind of on your own, you can explore it. So here's the question. Here's the question we're now turning towards. What is the first fundamental aspect of life we're invited to explore? And as we explore it, as Lectio Divina, see, as Lectio Divina, where am I personally at in my understanding, in my experience of this dimension of my Christian faith? Does that make sense in a way? See, that's Lectio Divina. See, how did the book encounter me in my life? And where am I at with respect to being in collusion with perhaps superficial and unhealthy attitudes? And where do I find in Christ a call to go deeper and find a certain intimate radicality that I'm invited to bear witness to in the world? To look at it that way. And the first theme, and in the introduction, Philip, he goes through these things. He gives like one paragraph on each one. And the first one is the memory of the song. And what he seems to, a lot of these things are closely overlapped, I mean, because they're kind of nuanced. But in the memory of the song, which is Roman numeral X1112, Roman numeral 12, in the prelude, is that that what we find in Christ in the Celtic tradition is the emphasis is not on becoming something other than ourselves, but on becoming truly ourselves. Christ discloses to us the sacred root of our being and of all being. And so what he seems to be suggesting is that in the common attitudes of the church, what you tend to have missing is a sense of the sacredness of life itself. Where in the Celtic tradition, you see this witness to the sacredness of life itself. So I would now like to give an example of a contemplative mystical sense of the sacredness of life itself. Quoting one or two mystics and so on. So first, on the sense of the sacredness of life itself and how Christ reveals that to us. And here I'd like to go to Meister Eckhart, the first mystic. And I'd like to put this in kind of the words of Meister Eckhart, how Eckhart tends to approach it. It goes like this. That God is the word we use for reality itself. God is reality itself. That God is beginningless reality itself. God never wasn't. Because if God ever wasn't, where would God come from? So God always was. And since God always was, God always will be. Because where would God go? So God is the word that we use for infinite reality itself. Now, this infinite reality itself that we call God really is beyond all names. Is engaged or expressed in an activity, in a dynamic activity of creation. And the activity of creation, this reality, is giving reality to all that is real. See, that reality gives reality to all that is real. And we are that reality. That the whole universe and everything in it, all of us sitting here in this room, are that reality. That if we think of God as generosity, that the generosity of the infinite is infinite, and we are the generosity of God. So that if at the count of three, God would stop loving you into your chair, at the count of three, your chair would be empty. In other words, that there is really our God-given godly nature, our God-given godly nature. And that God is emptying herself, pouring herself, giving herself at the concrete immediacy of your very reality. And this is the reality of everyone in this room, everyone in the world, the reality of the chair you're sitting on, this and all things. This is what the church teaches. And when you really look at the Gospels, read the fathers of the church, read the kind of substantial teaching of the church. This is the teaching of the church. That the earth is God's body, and that it embodies forth the love that's entering it into being. It's true that, see, that without God we're nothing, absolutely nothing. And in other words, you can't say this, for example. You know, God's here with me now, all about me and within me. And I'm so glad God is here because it really helps the morning go better. It isn't as if the morning's going better because God's here. And it wouldn't go quite so well if God wasn't. If God wasn't here, there'd be no morning. There's no you. That you're absolutely nothing without God. But here's the thing. Being absolutely nothing without God makes your very presence to be the very presence of God. Being manifested in and as your very presence. So if you could, right now, if you could see all that you really are, like interiorly see it experientially, all that you really are, you'd see God. So you'd see infinite reality giving itself away as your very reality. But you do not belong to yourself. You didn't bring yourself into existence. You cannot sustain yourself in existence. Your next breath belongs more to God than to you. But although it is God, God gives your breath away as your breath. And this is the sacred song that that God sings. And we are that song. And this is the teaching of the church. This is the teaching of Christianity. So anybody who makes any sense, you know, you open up the mystics and read it, this is it. Seriously. Does that mean that in the day-by-day person in the pew and what you're from the pulpit, you don't hear this spoken about enough? It does mean that. Too bad we don't hear it more. But does it not mean it is actually at the heart of the lives of many Christian people? It's not true, it is in the lives of many Christian people. And the lives of many people committed to ministry, and they bear witness to it and how they treat each other. And the value of their life as their family members, their life, their so on like that. So that's the first thing, I think. And I think what this invites us to then is then to see how Christ fits into this. See, then how do we see Christ in these terms? What's the Christian way of looking at all of this? And if what we're saying so far is Genesis 1:1, see, in the beginning God said, let there be light. Ab origine, in the beginning. And this is the virginal newness of every moment. This is the beginning. This very moment is that beginning. That we're being uttered into this present moment by reality itself. And so now the New Testament echoes it in Christian terms. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And the Word was God. And all things were made through Him. And without Him has been made nothing that has been made. So here's the traditional Christian understanding of Christ. That God is ineffable, hidden. And the eternal hiddenness of God is being eternally expressed as divine relations of knowledge and love. So intimacy is the first expression of the hiddenness of God. God the Father is the relation of knowing. If it was a matriarchal society, it'd be God the Mother. It is God is origin. And God the Father eternally speaks. And what does he speak? He speaks himself. That's the Logos, the Word. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word is with God, and the Word was God. So God the Father eternally is speaking God, and his spoken Word is God as spoken. And then God eternally contemplates himself in the Word. God the contemplative. God speaks himself, and then God is eternally contemplating himself in the Word. And God eternally contemplates in the Word the eternal possibility of all things. So that when God creates fire, God does not have to think up what fire might be. From all eternity, God eternally knows what fire eternally is. For God eternally contemplates fire in Christ the Word. And when God says, let there be fire, God brings into existence what fire eternally is in him forever before the origins of the universe. This is why you can contemplate the flames. You gaze into the flames and it's intimations of divinity. You get the intuition. No matter how long you would gaze into the flames, you would never exhaust what you catch glimpses of there, because it's inexhaustible. It's inexhaustible. See, this is the fire that never goes out, because it's the fire that never began. And God bears it forth. See? So God is the infinity of fire, and fire is the concrete immediacy of God. And so with water, so with birds, so with trees. And this is why we can contemplate the world as God's body. See that? And when God created you, God didn't have to think up who you might be. You were a particularly challenging case, by the way. Like, I had got stumped, we got together and discussed it at length. Quite agree. From all eternity, God the Father eternally contemplates who you eternally are before the origins of the universe, hidden with Christ in God forever. And when God created you, God said, fiat, let there be you. God brings into existence who you eternally are in him before the origins of the universe. This is the you that will never die, because it was the you that was never born. And God creates you in your humanity as a person, as a human person. Why? Why? So that as a human person, you might awaken to who God eternally knows you to be, which is religious experience. See, Gabriel Marcel says, we know we've loved someone when we've glimpsed in them that which is too beautiful to die. And you know you've learned to love yourself, and you've glimpsed in yourself that which is too beautiful to die. The beloved is too beautiful to die. You glimpse the deathless beauty of the beloved. And in that glimpse of love, you join God, and you see through eyes that once God's in your own, who God eternally knows the beloved is. And you are the beloved. You are the beloved. And God's waiting for you to join him in seeing who you eternally knows him, you to be in him forever before the origins of the universe. Why? And this is religious experience. This is the vibrancy of the heart, where your heart quickens with a sense of something like in the immediacy of the incomprehensible. I cannot explain it. The fact I cannot explain it does not mean I'm not experiencing it. I'm experiencing what I cannot explain, which is my God-given godly nature. So that then in your free will you might say yes to it and come home. Because love is never imposed, it's always offered. See, we're to freely, the reciprocity of love is we're to freely reciprocate love by freely choosing to be who God knows we eternally are, which is paradise. And how do we reciprocate that? By giving ourselves in love to the love that gives itself to us. And by giving ourselves in love to the love that gives itself to us, we come home. This is the reciprocity of love coming home to itself. Like this. So here's Jesus now. So Adam and Eve, they're walking around like this. And this is their big chance. And God says, look at this garden and this wonderful here. So beautiful. Look at this place that I prepared for you. And you can run around here, pet the animals, and run around in your new season, eat the fruit. It's great. Now, there's only one thing you can't do. You can't eat the fruit of this one tree. Which, by the way, I put right in the middle of the garden, so you have to pass it every day. You can do anything else you want. It's yours. It's yours. Boundaryless joy. And I'm going to come in the cool of the evening. We'll have a little walk. And you can tell me about your day. I just love listening to you, really, and how your day went. And so God says, you get the picture? And we do. And enjoy yourselves. Enjoy. And I'll see you later. See you tonight. They wave goodbye to God. God waves goodbye. They look at each other like this. And they eat the fruit. Okay? It's just the knowledge of good and evil. And so, what is the? It's a myth about the wayward tendencies of our heart. And instead of saying yes, we say no. And we sabotage the precious. And we perpetuate violence upon ourselves and upon one another. It's the mythic story of this propensity of the heart's waywardness to go into these cul-de-sacs where it never finds what it's looking for. So what is God's response to this dilemma? God's response to us in our dilemma, which is Christ, is God becomes identified with us as invincibly precious in our confusion. See, this is compassion. Compassion is that love that goes forth to identify with the preciousness of all this lost and broken. So Jesus roams the earth looking for people. He walks up to somebody suffering. Read the miracle stories in the gospel. They all go like this. They're suffering. He acknowledges their suffering. He looks through the suffering to see the root of their suffering. What is the root of their suffering? It's their belief that they are what's wrong with them. It's the belief that they are nothing but the self things happen to. It's the belief that has been seduced by circumstances. Is that the only happiness I can have is the happiness of maintaining conditions conducive to happiness. And since I have leprosy, since my daughter died, since this happened, since that happened, I'm bereft and I'm lost. So Jesus acknowledges all of that. He looks right through the rubble of their pain and sees in them who they were in him before the origins of the universe. And they see reflected in his eyes their deathless self. And this is experiential salvation. Experiential salvation is glimpsing in the eyes of Christ the reflection of your true face, as the Buddhists would say, before your parents were born. Identity. It comes home to identity. And you accept it. You accept it. Now, this is Christ. This is the Christ. And this is the teaching of the tradition. Next thing, which is now plays out in this one thing I now said just on nuances, the book endlessly nuances it, is original sin. Original sin. And the original sin is that we somehow have to turn into something else to be okay. That's the attitude. And here's the impression the church gives. And Newell's right. It kind of goes like this. Let's say you would die without accepting Jesus as your Lord and Savior. Or you would die with mortal sin on your soul without going to confession. And you die and you're facing God and God goes, you know what, I'll tell you this exactly, you know what? I don't like you. You're kind of repulsive to me, and I don't blame you for having low self-esteem. Trust me, you're on the right track. And I got the flush handle right here. And next. That's the impression you get. Really. So if you're not very, 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 very careful, you won't make it. Because it's very, very, very easy to go to hell. Really. It's one impure thought without being sorry for it, you're finished. I don't know. So what is original sin? And in a way that there is that attitude. I was teaching at a Catholic school. There was a nun there in this school, elderly sister, and maybe in the early 70s. She taught the students this in the class. She taught the girls this in the class. If you have your boyfriend over, if you have your boyfriend over for dinner, do not have linen tablecloths. Remind them of bed sheets. It'll remind them of bed sheets, and it'll have impure thoughts over the dinner. And we all know why girls should not wear patent leather shoes. So let's face it, we have all heard this. So this is not to say this isn't true, but that is not the tradition. And it's not what many people have taught, many people believe. It's just not the tradition. It isn't like Rome teaches this. You go to the roots of the tradition, the saints, the mystics, the teachings of the Vedanta, the church. So what is original sin? What is it? Here's one way of putting it. Here's how they tended to approach it. God said, let us make the human person in our image and likeness. And so the fathers of the church took this image and likeness, and they made a distinction. The image, the imago, the image is the person. The likeness is the human nature. See, when God creates a person, God creates the capacity for God. That Dan Walsh used to say at the monastery that before creation there was no capacity for love in God, because God is love. See, octus plurissimus. Therefore God creates the capacity for the infinite love that God is. Ka pax Dei. God creates the capacity for God, and that's you. That's your person. That's who you are as a person. There are three kinds of persons: eternal persons, divine persons, and created persons. Created persons are given an angelic nature or a human nature. And so our person, what we share in common with God is person, the personal, and with all the angels as persons, all of us as persons, is that we're a capacity for the infinite. A ka pax Dei. Merton says, it is that in you that is not subject to the brutalities of your own will. That's a great statement. There is that in you that is not subject to the brutalities of your own will. No matter how badly you trash yourself, this remains untrashed, because it's untrashable, because it belongs completely to God. This is who you are. This is who you are. That's the image. The likeness is the human nature. This person, this relation to God, is given a nature, the likeness. So that through the nature, we're to recognize the person that we are and say yes to it. And the nature is wounded. The nature is wounded. The nature is impotent to actualize the fulfillment of who we are as persons. See, that's our dilemma as human beings, is that we're powerless to achieve that without which life remains forever incomplete. We are powerless to achieve, by our own efforts, that without which life remains forever incomplete. This ceases to be a dilemma when you realize that which you are powerless to attain attains itself in you and your powerlessness to attain it. In your very powerlessness to attain it, it attains itself in you. In your very powerlessness to attain it. Amazing grace, amazing grace, amazing grace. In all life is like this. Lovers cannot make the moments of oceanic oneness happen. They cannot make that sweet communion of oneness happen. It can't be fabricated by sheer brute force of their will. But they can freely choose to assume the stance that offers the least resistance to being overtaken by it, which is spiritual practice of intimacy. But when it happened, they didn't make it happen. It's that they took the chance, that they took it, the stance that offered the least resistance to love occurring. The poet cannot make the poem happen. The poet cannot force the poem out onto the paper. If so, it rings with ego. It has a kind of shallow feel to it, as something fabricated. But the poet can assume the inner stance that offers the least resistance to being overtaken by the gift of poetry, flowing through them onto the paper. You see that in a way? The artist can't make beauty happen. If so, it's just crafts. You get your square like this with the numbered holes in it. You take the colored yarn. You put all the reds in number one, all the blues in number one. Voila, you have a windmill. But that's fabrication. A creation of beauty requires, this, as Rollo May says, the courage to create. You have to lean into what your powerlessness to make happen. And out of the acceptance of that powerlessness, it shines forth, like it comes out in that very willingness. Well, there's a Zen story about a well-known Zen koan where this monk is trying very, very hard to be enlightened. And it's not going well for the monk. And the Zen master says, come to my room tonight at 6. So he comes to his room, he goes in, and the Zen master is rubbing two bricks together. He says, what are you doing? He said, I'm rubbing these bricks together to make mirrors. Polishing bricks to make two mirrors. And he laughs and says, you'll never make mirrors by rubbing bricks together. He says, either will you be enlightened by trying so hard. And it says, the story says, at that point the monk was enlightened. See, what you see, that you, it's true, unless you try very, very hard, you probably won't be enlightened, but if you are enlightened, it won't be because you tried so hard. Because it's not because of anything at all. It's never the effect of a cause. It always arises unexplainably in your heart, like beauty, like love. And God is the infinity of beauty. God's the infinity of love. God's the infinity of clarity. And so original sin, then, is the woundedness of our nature, in which we tend to roam about, compromising and sabotaging what we long for the most. We do this how we treat each other. We do this to each other in our families. We do it in the church. You know, we do it how we treat our bodies, how we treat our minds. I'm a psychotherapist. I listen to it all day long. And I do it to myself, too. This weird propensity towards withholding the treasure that we long for. As if we don't deserve it, or we're not allowed to do it. It's very intimate and strange, really. So original sin is not that we're bad. It never teaches that we're... It isn't like that. Original sin is acknowledging the woundedness of our nature, so that we might acknowledge it with humility and be set free. Someone once said they feel safer in an AA meeting than they do in church. Because in an AA meeting you have the collective acknowledgement of brokenness, but you have paradoxical wholeness in the acknowledgement of brokenness. In a church, it ain't necessarily so. The church should be the refuge of sinners. It should be the place where the broken come to discover they're invincibly whole in their fragility, not in spite of it. Am I holy yet? Am I holy yet? Is this good enough? How is this? It's just tragic, really. Then we project that onto God, if that's the way God sees us. Oh, too bad you didn't quite make it. Next, the rhythm of the earth. The rhythm of the earth, chapter 3, on the kind of the rhythm of nature. And the earth, the church tends not to respect the divinity of the ecology, the divinity of nature, the divinity of the material world. And that's true. Often enough, it doesn't do that anymore. But the Christian tradition, the roots of the tradition, and as it's often taught, it really, you don't find that. You do find a deep respect for the tradition. Mm-hmm. A few texts on this, a few thoughts on this, for you to see this. St. John of the Cross says, he says, in the beginning, the beauty of the material world is a seduction. Because in possessiveness of heart, we try to own it to gratify ourselves. See, short-term gratification through material pleasure. So this is true. He says, as we start to mature on the spiritual path, as we start to wise up and start to clear our head, he says, next you begin to realize the beloved has passed this way in haste. you see traces of infinite love in the sound of the rain, the smell of the roads, the darkness of the night, stars in the sky. You see traces that the beloved has passed this way in haste. And then he says, in the end, you realize, he says, my beloved is the mountains. My beloved is the mountains. That the mountains are God's body, and that they body forth the love that's uttering them into being. Meister Eckhart says, this is a great little text of Meister Eckhart. He says, you know, let's take a house fly. It's a nice place to start. And let's say you're sitting there in meditation, like you're sitting there in contemplation like this, and there's a house fly buzzing in the window. And it's distracting the depth of your search for God. So you get up and you take a book or something, and you fly with your new seat of contemplation. Wipe it off, get back to your prayer cushion. Now, where was I, Lord? Now, Eckhart says this. Eckhart says, think a minute. Flies are what God eternally knows that they are in Christ before the origins of the universe. See, there's the fly that never began, the fly that will never die, the fly that God said, let it be, when God said, let it be to fly. And God brings forth into existence what flies eternally are on this earth. He said, you just swatted God. You know, in some religions about nonviolence, you know, not eating meat, not eating, not killing an insect, this is the mystical intuition behind that. That there's something sacred about all living things. And I'm not saying you shouldn't swat the fly, but you shouldn't swat them indiscriminately. Here's what I do at home. Let's say I'm standing at the kitchen sink doing some dishes, and there's a fly in the window. You know how they try to go towards the sunlight and kind of like, so what you do in your more grounded moment, you slide the window open, you kind of shoo it out. And as it flies off, you're happy for the fly. You feel good about yourself. Now, sometimes the fly doesn't cooperate, and it won't go towards the window. Screw this, and you swat it. Doesn't always go the way it Meister Eckhart makes a statement. He says, if we could get a hold of things in their original emanation, that is, as they flow in their virginal immediacy from God, we see the godly nature of the smallest of things. Here's the mystery. The totality of God is totally given to everything. That every grain of sand, the infinity of God is infinitely given as that grain of sand. God doesn't parcel it out. Little for you, little for you, little. But the mystery is the totality of the smallest of things is the concrete immediacy of the infinity of God. That's why to see a single grain of sand absolutely would be to see God. Does that make sense in a way? Intuitively, logic does not grasp this. But the awakened heart knows that it's true. There's something trustworthy and boundaryless about simple things. I will end with this image on this one, and here with this one. Irving Yalom, an existential psychotherapist, Irving Yalom wrote a book called Existential Psychotherapy. And in the book, he describes the death of a poet. I think it's Yeats. And in this deathbed scene, Yeats, the poet's on his deathbed. It's in the middle of a bright summer day. So the poet's bed is against a window, and the window shade's pulled down. And there's a tree branch right outside that window shade, up against the window. And there's a bird hopping around on the tree branch, so you can see the shadow of the bird on the whole window shade. And there's two or three people standing around the deathbed, no one's saying anything. The poet turns his head slightly towards the shadow of the bird on the window shade, and tears come down his face, and he dies. I was once giving a retreat, and these silent retreats I lead, there's often all-night adoration of the Eucharist on Saturday nights, so you can get up during the night and do sittings before the Eucharist. And someone came to see me on a Sunday morning, and she said to me, she was sitting in the chapel, and they had a prayer cushion, Zafus, there, and you could go up and sit on the floor up in the sanctuary, like this. And they had a large vase of roses on the altar. And she came to me and said she was sitting in the chapel. And she said she was sitting there for over 2 hours, middle of the night. And you know how when the silence is complete, it like rings in your ears, just complete silence. And she was sitting on the floor at the foot of the altar in the middle of the night. And one of the petals fell from one of the roses and hit the floor where she was sitting. And it was so silent, she said she heard it hit and burst into tears. The unbearable beauty of the smallest of things. God giving yourself away completely in that, like that. Like nothing's missing anywhere. The heart can hardly bear it. The heart cannot bear it. It goes on forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. And so, really, this is the God-given godly nature of the earth that bodies forth the love that's loving all things into being. And I'll end then with this quote from Thomas Merton, then we'll take a break on this. This is Thomas Merton. This is New Seeds of Contemplation, page 128. And you get this sense of like this intimate contemplative sense of God's presence in deep prayer and this mystical Christianity sense of the universe. This is 128 of Merton's prayers. Merton is sitting after Mass in the chapel of the novitiate at the monastery, and he would say Mass, celebrate Mass, and then he would sit for silent prayer after Mass, and he's sitting there, and there's a vase of carnations on the altar, and he says this: beauty of sunlight falling on a tall vase of red and white carnations and green leaves on the altar of the novitiate chapel. The light and dark, the darkness of the fresh crinkled flower. Light warm and red all around the darkness. The flower is the same color as blood, but it is in no sense whatever as red as blood, not at all. It is as red as a carnation, only that. This flower, this light, this moment, this silence, Dominus est, God is. Eternity, he passes, he remains, we pass, in and out. He passes, we remain, we are nothing, we are everything. He is in us, he is gone from us, he is not here, we are here in him. All these things can be said, but why say them? The flower is itself, the light is itself, the silence is itself, I am myself. All perhaps illusion, but no matter. For illusion is the shadow of reality, and reality is the grace and gift that underlies all these lights, these colors, this silence. Underlies, is that true? They are simply real. They themselves are his gift. He continues. Although I see the stars, I no longer pretend to know them. Although I have walked in those woods, how can I claim to love them? One by one, I shall forget the names of individual things. You who sleep in my breast are not met with words, but in the emergence of life within life and of wisdom within wisdom. You are found in communion. Thou and me and I and thee and thou and them. Dispossession within dispossession. Thou art alone. The Father and I are one. You're sitting out somewhere in the midst of the woods or by the ocean. And in some mysterious way, it's given to you to realize that although you are not God, you're not other than God either. Although you are not other people, you are not other than other people either. And although you are not the ocean, you're not other than the ocean either. Although you are not the sky, you're not other than the sky either. Although you are not the sand beneath your feet, you're not other than the sand either. And there's this mysterious interconnectedness of everything. A kind of sweet communion that's realized as the divinity of the concreteness of life itself. So let's end on that little note. We'll pick up after the break and round this out and have dialogue.